Alrighty. So tonight we continue a series that we began kind of or recommenced this morning called Wisdom in Practice. And if you were here this morning, this first part of the sermon is going to sound oddly similar because I don't want to assume that everyone was here this morning. And I do want to introduce what is going on when it comes to this category and genre of literature in the Bible that's known as wisdom literature. This series we began actually at the beginning of the year. I think Elijah actually kicked it off in the AM right at the beginning of the year, and we're kind of picking it up mid-year, and we'll pick it up a little bit toward the end of the year. But basically what this series is an opportunity to pair a piece of wisdom literature, which I'll get to in a moment, with an example from the Bible of that wisdom that has been put in practice. Because like a lot of the Bible, it's very easy, if you really wanted to kind of just pick up a verse and pretty much make it say whatever you want. You can pick up a verse and consider it to be a promise. You can pick up a verse and consider that same verse to be a piece of advice. You can pick up that same verse and be like, well, that's just interesting. We need to know what we're working with, and we need to be honest about how a said wisdom can be put into practice. And so within the Bible, there's this genre of literature known as wisdom literature. It's probably most famous book, I suppose, within the Bible is the book of Proverbs. But of course, wisdom literature is contained in all sorts of other books. In fact, in Hebrew tradition, even the book of Joshua is wisdom literature. So there's a nice little fact for you. But wisdom literature is often displayed as these kind of short little axioms, these little lines. Sometimes they're contrasting, sometimes they're little bits of narrative that are designed to communicate something quite profound in a very succinct and small way. Now, this was a really important genre of literature because, first and foremost, this style of literature was a gift to the people and the nation of Israel. Now, the story of the nation of Israel was they would go through these cycles, right, which we go through as well. They would spend some time in exile, which basically means they were overtaken by another nation. They had disobeyed God, and so he allowed them to be overtaken by another nation. And then they would cry out, recognizing their disobedience, and then they'll cry out and God would liberate them in some way, in some form of exodus, and then the cycle would kind of continue as they became an empire, the very thing that God had freed them from, and then they got overtaken by empire to feel that experience, to then cry out and once again go through that cycle. And again, we don't want to come across is too judgmental because we can do that very same thing. Nevertheless, wisdom literature was primarily used as tools for the journey. That's what wisdom literature is about. It's about these people who are navigating this journey and even these cycles of both success and pain and poverty and enrichment and saying, what do I need to understand about how life works? Especially life based upon what I'm experiencing right now. And so you're going to find wisdom literature that deals with interpersonal issues, conflict. It's going to deal with money and finances. It's going to deal with parenting and child relationships. You're going to find wisdom literature that seems to speak to nearly every kind of context. And they can all be in the same chapter too. So we want to make sure we know what we're working with, knowing that these can be tools that we can pick up, particularly during difficult times, just as they were for the nation of Israel, particularly in exile. One of the examples we get of the purpose of the Proverbs is contained in Proverbs 3:1-2, where the author says, "My son, do not forget my teaching, but keep my commands in your heart, for they will prolong your life many years and bring you peace and prosperity." Now, apart from the beautiful alliteration of all those three words, you know, prosper, prolong, peace, there's something about these kind of characteristics where we're like, yeah, I want that. I want to prolong my life for the most part. I want peace. I want prosperity in the most, you know, generous sense of that. That isn't just about like monetary wealth. This is about prospering, right, in a whole sense. And so we want these things, not just for ourselves, we actually want these for others, right? It might be sometimes even feel a little dangerous or a little bit selfish to be kind of like, oh, I want to prosper. But all of these tools for the journey weren't just for the individuals, they were for the whole faith community, they were for the whole nation, they were for our neighbors as well as for ourselves. What does it look like for peace to enter this person's world as they go through interpersonal conflict? What does it look like for this person to prosper after they have just made terrible decisions around how to handle their finances? What does it look like for this person to extend their life when, you know, maybe they would win the Darwin Awards because, you know, on Territory Night, they're shooting fireworks at the wrong direction, you know? Now, it may not get exactly that specific, but it actually does have examples all throughout wisdom literature of, like, literally how to prolong your life, right? How to prosper and how to establish peace. And so when aligned with God's wills, these are excellent things to actually seek after, which is why we do want to engage in wisdom literature. And tonight, our topic is the topic of gentleness. Gentleness. Now, gentleness is one of those fruit that is listed by Paul as the fruit of the Spirit. It's always a really interesting one because I think sometimes people shy away from it. But I love this, this spiritual fruit of gentleness, because what is gentleness but power under control? Right? That's the simplest definition of gentleness. It's power under control. All right? So it isn't being like all meek and mild and like shying away or like, ooh. It's I have the ability to control the power that I have. And interestingly, particularly as a father raising two boys, gentleness is something I really want them to grow well into. It's like I feel like if they can actually navigate and produce the fruit of gentleness, it's actually going to serve them and all their relationships really, really well. So it's actually a bit of a passion, a project of mine, particularly in this area, which is why I'm excited by tonight's proverb that we're going to be engaging with. And this is our proverb for tonight, which again, I'll later pair with a story. It says in Proverbs 15:1-2, a gentle answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. The tongue of the wise adorns knowledge, but the mouth of the fool gushes folly. Now, I don't know about you, when I hear these words, I can't help but actually think of a whole bunch of circumstances that just kind of come to mind. I don't necessarily want to be all judgy, but I look at these words and I'm like, I know these times when I have not provided a gentle answer and it has caused more wrath. Or maybe I happen to know a few people who seem to strike me as that kind of fool that gushes a little bit of folly from time to time. And maybe it's me. But when you hear these bits of wisdom literature, it's right and true and good for them to prompt these stories or even people sometimes in our mind, right? Because that is what actually reminds us that this truth is super relevant. It's super important tool for the journey. If we can get this kind of thing right, apparently it's going to help us prolong our life, live with greater peace, and live with greater prosperity. And I think we can all agree that we get a bit of a contrast here. Two different trajectories depending upon how we answer. And this is what I want to highlight first and foremost. Sometimes with these wisdom literatures, you just kind of got to look at the surface level and identify something that is just obvious but really true. And if you don't say it, everyone's like, why didn't you just say that? And this is the first truth that I just want us to identify. Every response that we make, every response holds the potential to heal or destroy. Now, you might be kind of like, whoa, that's some like loaded words, like heal, like destroy. Like, but at the same time, the wisdom, the writer of this wisdom literature doesn't hold back also on the language that they use. They say a gentle answer turns away wrath. I mean, wrath, it's a loaded image, isn't it? It's like this sense of like consequence and like judgment. And so there's this real sense, it's like actually the way that we respond genuinely has the possibility of setting the trajectory on the nature of this relationship. Is it going to head it more and more toward a healing place, or is it going to head it more toward an area of destruction? You see, I think intuitively, perhaps through experience, and particularly as you grow older and older, you realize that you know that words have power. You're like, I know my words have power. And in James, we'll talk about that all the time in the Bible as well. But so often, we actually don't necessarily consider the stakes of our responses. And I think this is where this piece of wisdom literature actually gets a little bit more profound. Because the thing that it highlights here is it talks about a gentle answer. This is talking about how we respond to others. We're talking about situations where we are not initiating, right? And that is different, because if you've got a blank canvas and you're like, I'm initiating the conversation, you can be like, all right, I'm going to craft my words. I'm going to be deliberate about the words that I use. I want these to generate healing rather than chaos. life rather than death. But in some ways, sometimes those conversations we initiate kind of act as that kind of neutral territory. But so often, the situation is that we are actually encountering something that has been thrown to us first. This wisdom is actually revealed in the conversations that we don't choose. It's when someone comes up to us and starts critiquing. Or someone comes up to us and says, you did this, or you should have done that. Or even gossip, did you notice that this person did this? And suddenly it's not a neutral conversation anymore. This thing has a bit of heat, right? And we have an opportunity in how we respond to either create more healing or create more destruction. When someone criticizes us or accuses us or interrupts us or misunderstands us, our words, our answer, even better, can either break the cycle or fuel the cycle of pain and hurt. And I know that many of you will have actually experienced this reality at one point or another. And what's fascinating about this is we see Jesus in exactly one of these situations where these stakes are really, really high, not just for him, but for everyone involved. And that's what I want to focus on tonight as we talk about our wisdom, this piece of wisdom in practice. We see here in John chapter 8, a story that may be familiar to some. It's often called the woman caught in adultery. It says in John 8, verses 1 to 5, but Jesus went to the Mount of Olives. Stuff happened prior to that, but he's gone to the Mount of Olives. At dawn, he appeared again in the temple courts where all the people gathered around him and he sat down to teach them. The teachers of the law and the Pharisees brought in a woman caught in adultery. They made her stand before the group and said to Jesus, "Teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. In the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. Now what do you say?" So a bit of context just for clarity in case this is the first time you've encountered this text. Now, this was a completely unjust situation. We discover later in the text that they are creating this situation in order to trick Jesus, right? But actually, first and foremost, they are deceiving themselves because in Levitical law, yes, there was a need for stoning in the case of the Levitical law, but it wasn't just for the woman, right? And apparently this woman was caught in the act of adultery, and you have to ask the question, where's the guy, right? Where's the guy? So this whole situation is completely unjust. They are setting Jesus up to fail, at least in their eyes. And so this is not an appropriate kind of situation, and in order for actually any judgment to be passed, the man ought to be there as well, all right? So just to be really, really clear. Because it does seem appropriately unjust. But we see this like really loaded situation. Like the stakes are high. Jesus is being asked to engage in a really strong law and ethical kind of issue. Hey, Jesus, where are you at on this? And the stakes are high. Are we going to stone this woman? Are we going to kill this woman for this act? Are you going to obey the Levitical law? Are you going to defy the Levitical law? Like, this is high stakes. And you've got this crowd of people, and you don't know how many of the crowd are kind of stirring up the trouble and how much they are just witnesses to this whole deal. But the stakes are really high. And you can imagine the tension in this moment. Okay, they've posed this question. They say, now what do you say? And in the back of my mind, I've got this piece of wisdom literature saying, you know, a gentle word avoids wrath, right? And there is a potential for some serious wrath going down in this situation. Now, I just want to, with that in mind, I just want to head back to our proverb. And I will come back to the adorning knowledge, but in the second part of verse 2 there, it says, the tongue of the wise adorns knowledge, but the mouth of the fool gushes folly. Gushes folly. Has this image, I don't know if you get the same image, I think of like, you know, kind of like almost the mouth of a river and just or like, you know, a hydrant, you know, one of those fire hydrants that just, you know, has blasted out. I know along here on our Brown Street for a while, we had a big water geyser coming out for days as they were trying to work out where the hole in the ground was. And it was just gushing and gushing and gushing. I'm looking at all that water roll down the street and my heart is breaking. But at the same time, I'm thinking, gosh, that's what it looks like. It just gushes folly. How much is going to come out? When is it possibly going to stop? Surely this isn't helping. And yet, We don't see Jesus as one who gushes folly, who uses heaps of words in this heavy, loaded, high-stakes situation. Instead, we see him do something different. Because gentleness will often require us to create time and space. And this is the opposite of gushing folly, right? It's actually about saying, I'm going to create some time and I'm going to create some space in order to determine exactly what my response is going to be and to identify the temperature of this situation. Because every conversation has a temperature. Could be heightened emotions, sometimes there's a sense of urgency, sometimes there's a mixed history. But the temperature that we add or take to a conversation is essential to avoid escalation. And that's why the fool gushes folly, but the gentle answer requires time and space. I love this example. Here's Matty Cann with all his meat. Apologies for vegetarians in the room. The other week we had a little experiment with some year 11, 12 boys called the Wilds, and Maddie and I were really keen that after our 24 hours of fasting, we would do feasting, right? Discipline of feasting and fasting, good disciplines. And this is Maddie preparing the meat, a good 600 gram steak for every single one of the boys who came. And as I was chatting to Maddie about this, and you're lucky if you have a friend like Matt, right? You need a friend who loves meat and loves cooking meat, you know. He would say the key, right, the key to a really, really good steak is the time you give it to marinate. And I'm not just talking like a marinate, I'm talking like salt water, which I know sounds really weird, right? But he would make a brine, right, out of water and salt, and he'd put the steaks in there and they would sit in the fridge, you know, 24 hours, 48 hours, right, in advance. Just sitting there in this salty water. And yet, the difference that that makes, right, to the steak at the end, so that it can actually be cooked to perfection, is what it needs. It requires time and space in order, right, to be effective. I remember when I was going through what they call panels as part of my formation, so something you do when you kind of on a kind of pastor trajectory is you go through a process of discernment. You get wise people to basically ask you questions to make sure you're on the right track. And we would call this panels. And every 12 months, you'd go and be interviewed essentially by this group of people that you did not know, but represented an immense amount of wisdom from the movement. It was one of the most scary days of the year because they had the choice on whether or not you could continue that journey or whether you would pause, right? And do another year before progressing. And I remember distinctly this particular moment, and I was really privileged to go through this process at a particularly young age. And as you may know about me, if you know me well, I'm a bit of an infielder, they call it. You know, someone will ask a question and I'll kind of go for an answer pretty quick. And they asked me a particular question, and I don't even remember what the question was, but I remember responding as best I knew how. And I started responding, and one of the people in the room, they just said, just wait. They said, wait, Gavin. They said, just take a moment. Take a moment. And then respond. And I remember sitting there. I can't even pause in that moment. Isn't that weird? I remember sitting there and going, how long do I have to pause? How long do I have to pause? How long are they waiting me to pause? Like going this. And they weren't saying that what I said was wrong. They were just saying, just take a moment, slow down. Just give us some thought. Let the question linger a little while. And I always remember this moment because there's a sense in which it's like, that's what gentleness requires. Just take that little bit extra time, that little bit extra space. Be encouraged to be an outsider for a moment. And this is what Jesus does. I love this in verse 6. They were using this question as a trap in order to have a basis for accusing him, right? But Jesus bent down and started to write on the ground with his finger. So mysterious. When they kept on questioning him, he straightened up and said to them, "Let any one of you who is without sin be the first to throw a stone at her." And then verse 8, again, he stooped down and wrote on the ground. At this, those who heard began to go away one at a time, the older ones first, until only Jesus was left with the woman standing there. Now, I love this. Such a cool example of this wisdom in practice, right? High temperature, high stakes interaction, where they have provoked it, his has a responsibility to respond, right? He didn't set the scene, they created the scene. And Jesus just creates a bit of time and space. He's just going to draw some stuff on the ground. And we could have a big theological conversation about what he drew on the ground and was it to do with the festival of booths and all these remezes, and I could tell you all about that. But behind all that stuff and all that speculation, which the Bible doesn't explicitly tell us, the thing that it does tell us is he took time and space. He's just bending down there and just drawing on the ground. Interestingly, while he did this, verse 7, they kept on questioning him. Now, Jesus, we want a response. Come on. Respond to our question. And so he's like, all right. He gets up and he delivers a few convicting but gentle words. You can understand with a line like this how gentleness is power under control, right? Massive power under control here. And so when they keep questioning him, he responds, you know, let anyone who is without sin throw a stone. And then again, he makes more space. And this is really important to understand, particularly when it comes to gentleness. A gentle answer is not a weak answer. A gentle answer is not a weak answer. It's actually made powerful by consideration, by giving it that time and space, even while others are wanting to keep that temperature high. It's taking a breath and saying, have you considered this? Have you considered this? See, Jesus knew the crowd needed space to examine themselves, and so he created and gave them space. And I wonder if in our interactions with others, even if they keep on questioning us, actually our role as followers of Jesus seeking to put this wisdom into practice is to take a little bit more time just to write on the ground. You don't have to do that literally. You can. Be a funny response, wouldn't it? But just to take a bit more time to write on the ground, to ensure time and space is given, because, again, our answer has the possibility of creating healing or creating more pain and chaos. And lastly, I just want to focus on one more thing here that's contained within this piece of wisdom literature, this tool for the journey. It says, the tongue of the wise adorns knowledge. And I think this is just a really good practical thing, because we don't always know when we're going to encounter these situations. We don't know these times where people are going to accuse us or misunderstand us, or our kid's going to, you know, speak harshly to us, or our colleague at work is going to, you know, share some, again, you know, something maybe even untrue about somebody else and invite us into gossip. But we can proactively adorn or clothe, you could say, our tongue or our words with knowledge that brings both conviction and truth. You see, wisdom responses like, let the one who has never sinned cast the first stone, it rarely appears in the moment. I was encouraged by sometimes some of the God stories being shared. In fact, Rodney, you were just sharing one around how the way that, you know, God just brings a word to mind, you know, in the right time and moment. Like, isn't the Holy Spirit amazing in just his timing, bringing those words? But so often wisdom is actually already stored in our heart, right? And eventually what is in your heart ultimately fills your mouth. And so in a world of competing voices, it is so important that we actually spend time to immerse ourselves in what God says is true. Spending time in silence and spending time in solitude away from all the competing voices that exist within our world. Again, I know that one of the biggest challenges is to replace reckless folly, right, with righteous truth. When we were on the wilds, one of the things we did was we spent 6 hours in solitude. And we got to go around in literally 6 hours. You could do whatever you wanted, but it was like 6 hours of solitude. And I took a little hike up the mountain, and I took my Bible. And one of the things I wanted to do was memorize Psalm 63. And why Psalm 63? Because one of the boys had done a Devo on Psalm 62, and then it had caught my eye earlier in the day. And I thought, oh, that seems rich. It's about someone in the wilderness, David in the wilderness. And I started to memorize Psalm 63, and as I would walk by, I'd go through verse 1 and verse 2 and verse 3 and verse 4, and then I'd get to another location, and I'd go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and I'm just repeating it over and over again as I walked and walked. It's actually really hard to memorize Scripture. At least I found it to be hard to memorize Scripture. And yet I felt like it was filling me as I went. And I felt like it was storing something in my heart for wisdom to emerge later on. I think that can be true whether we have time in solitude or not. It's like we need to be adorning our tongue with wisdom, because what ultimately sits in our heart will come out of our mouth. Jesus in verse 10 says, he straightened up and asked her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" "No one, sir," she said. "Then neither do I condemn you," Jesus declared. "Go now and leave your life of sin." You know, Jesus was, again, incredibly aware of the stakes and of the context. He knew that they were trying to trap him, and yet here was a vulnerable woman, right? There was this moment of potential life and potential death. And Jesus makes it clear that the crowd's response, their step of obedience to his question, actually determined his response. "Then neither do I." It's a whole cultural piece going on there around how decisions are made. However, with that determination comes a instruction that is gentle. Because remember, gentleness does not mean that something is weak. A gentle answer is not a weak answer. He says, "Go now and leave your life of sin." And so Jesus in this moment, he neither compromises truth nor does he weaponize it like everyone else is trying to do. Right? It's a beautiful example of this piece of wisdom in practice. And so whether it is in our family or in our workplace or church, gentleness and the example of Jesus is available to us. I love how it's written, Colossians 5, Paul articulates, he says, "Be wise in the way that you act toward outsiders. Make the most of every opportunity. Let your conversation be always full of grace, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how to answer everyone." Isn't that beautiful, that word answer? "So that you may know how to answer everyone." Again, that invitation of how we respond really, really matters. And so, to sum up, in Proverbs 15:1-2, we have these beautiful words on gentleness. "A gentle answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. The tongue of the wise adorns knowledge, but the mouth of the fool gushes folly." We need to be reminded that every response that we have the opportunity to respond to holds the potential to heal or destroy. And so my question would be, are you alert to the risk of your response? Do you know the stakes in these environments? Gentleness will require us to create time and space, or often requires us to create time and space. Are there any particular relationships in your world right now where you need to spend a little bit more time writing on the ground with your finger? Just slowing the conversation down to ultimately benefit both you and that other person. And what does it look like to replace reckless folly with righteous fruit? Are you filling your life with truth to draw from? Because what ultimately enters our heart will emerge from our mouth. And so here in John, Jesus didn't just simply teach a gentle answer. He actually gave a gentle answer. And through his Spirit, he's forming that same gentleness in us. That's why it is one of the fruit of the Spirit. So my hope is that as followers of him and his example, we too can embrace a gentle response and see the fruit of that for his glory and for the benefit of the relationships around us. Let me pray. Jesus, we thank you, God, that your way is the best way. Thank you for your incredible example that serves as a reminder that even in high-stakes situations, there is the opportunity to protect those who are vulnerable, to pause and yet to speak with conviction so that all of us can walk away with greater peace, greater prosperity, and maybe even to prolong our life. And so God, may we put your wisdom into practice as we navigate this complex life with all its diversity, with all its beauty, and with all its pain. We pray this.